Hello, I'm John Ingold.
I'm Sagar Baruchi.
And welcome to the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope podcast. Each week, we open the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope book to a different article and invite the author on to discuss their chosen topic and more. So it's all about the craft and practice of interactive writing and narrative design. This week, we're really excited to have Mary Kenny with us. Hello, Mary.
Hello, I'm so excited to be here.
Could you please introduce yourself to the listeners and give us a little bit about your background and how you fit into the tapestry of games writers?
I am a senior writer and narrative director in video games. So I have worked on titles such as Marvel's Spider-Man Miles Morales, Marvel's Wolverine, which is coming out shortly. I've worked on Telltale's The Walking Dead Season 4 as well, and a bunch of other games on which I was a contractor. So in those roles, I have been a writer, of course. I've worked on plots and scripts and scripting and all of that exciting stuff. I've also worked in casting with actors and motion capture. So I've really gotten to oversee and help guide and create the narratives and the experiences of a lot of games that are really close to my heart.
We love that. So we start with the article that you've written for the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope. And your article is titled, How to Love the Player Who Hates You, Creating After or During Gamergate. Would you mind, Mary, summarizing the article for us and letting us know what it's all about?
Sure. So the article was, for me, a very interesting turn. If you've read my book, the entire introduction is how I don't want to talk about Gamergate. And so this article, that came out before I myself was a target of that kind of harassment. But one of the things we talk a lot, and we should, about the trauma and about what causes Gamergate and you know, how to combat it in online spaces. But what I really wanted to focus on with this article, what I was really excited about in this collection of essays, was the craft side. I don't think we spend enough time talking about how harassment impacts your craft. We talk a lot about how it impacts you as a person, which is important, but not how it impacts you as a creative. And I think it's critical, because a lot of people who have endured and survived that harassment leave their industries. They decide they don't want to do it anymore. And I completely don't blame them. But what happens to the people who don't? How do you get your verve back? How do you get back the desire to create something that really, in interactive writing, it's not just you creating and handing it off to an audience. We're creating something together. And how do you do that with an audience that it might feel like at one point turned on you? And that's what I wanted to explore in this essay. I did a lot of self-reflection. I did an interview. I talked to a lot of people about it. And I was really happy with where it ended up. I'm really happy it's part of the collection.
We're very, very happy to have it too. I think there were loads of things in it that were really interesting. But I think the first thing that sort of stood out to me was just the core thesis of the idea that, you know, when you're writing, you're always thinking about the player, as any writer is always thinking about their audience. But somehow there's something about the structure of games that makes the player, I don't know, is the player's voice loud? I mean, you've written across several media. I think that's right. Correct.
Sure.
Is the player's voice louder when you're writing for a game rather than, say, the reader of a comic book or the viewer of a film? Do you think it's a kind of,
absolutely,
closer to our players?
Yeah, certainly. I think when you're writing in different media, you're always thinking about who is your co-author, and that might be an actual writer. It might also, in comic books, it's the artist, right? They have just as much impact on the narrative as anybody else. In a book, when I was writing it, I had in my mind the idea of I'm sitting across from somebody in a coffee shop and we're having a really casual conversation. But then when I sat down to write it, I was like, yeah, but they never talk back. So I'm just ranting in a coffee shop at this point. So you always kind of have that in your mind. But with video games, it's what do I think the player is going to do here? What do I think they are going to feel here? Are they going to want to go left or right down this hallway? But also, are they going to respond to this character with sympathy and compassion? Or are they going to respond with frustration and I'm going to shove them off a cliff the next time we get to a cliff. And those are all definitely critical parts of writing branching narrative, which I have worked on. But it also comes up in linear narrative. You know, in Miles Morales and Wolverine, the story is not impacted in the same way by the player's choices. But you are taking action as the player. And we always talk about, how do we get you to feel that forward momentum? I have to pick this up again. I have to fight through some of the more difficult boss fights and puzzles and stuff to see what happens next, to see how this resolves. So, long answer short, that is our co-author. The player is our co-author in a really huge way. So they're always top of mind. How are they feeling? What do we want them to feel versus what are some new and exciting things they're going to feel that we didn't even anticipate? And what options do we want to give them? What verbs do we want to give them to respond to those emotions and act them out?
Because you've written so widely, Mary, and on bigger projects and on smaller ones, I wonder the extent to which the sort of mainstreamness of the project has an impact on this. It of course comes with maybe a bigger audience expectation if you're working with, say, an existing character that lives in other media as well, right? But have you found the relationship with the audience ever being, well, I suppose being more positive? Like is there a format in which you've had a more like a warmer interaction with them even before, say, the release of a game? I noticed in your back history that you've written for the Read Only Memories universe, which I was just so deeply in love with, for example. And it just makes me think, like, is there a difference in the indie scene versus maybe the more mainstream scene for these?
I think there's a small one, but it's not actually as big of a gulf as you might expect, because when you're writing on a project with a smaller audience, you reliably know that this is an audience that loves this product. I think, like, you know, if it's only going out to 15 people, those are the 15 people who are invested. They have signed up. They are, you know, a bigger percentage of them is participating in fan spaces. They're on AO3 adding fanfic. You know, they are invested in this universe. And that investment, I think, the majority of the time is very warm and open and exciting and passionate. I think there are also some downsides. They are very invested. And that means if you are taking a creative stab that they don't like, that can go badly sometimes, right? And it's just one of those things that you accept as a writer, especially a writer online. But I think you see that in the bigger audiences too. It's just the percentages are maybe different, right? Is that you have more, I would say, casual fans in bigger releases, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with a casual fan, but you have a lot of people who will play through your game, read your comic book, whatever, and put it down and, you know, never think about it again, or think about it very rarely. But at the same time, you have so many fans, maybe even a larger number of fans, that are just as invested as people who are reading and playing indie games. So overall, I think it's more similar than dissimilar. It's just in raw numbers, it's right. Obviously very different.
I love this idea of thinking of the player as a kind of as a co-author in some kind of emotional sense. Because I think sometimes when I'm writing, right, I fall back on kind of the academic background of my family. Mm-hmm. And I think, I am the author and I am telling you the story. You know, that kind of grand Tolkien style tradition or something. But I think it's really interesting the way that you sort of describe the player as, I don't know, someone that you're more in conversation with during the writing process. And so I guess my question, because I should have a question, is how do we go about challenging the player? Because if you come from an authorial point of view, right, if you're a classic novel author, you say, I know the truth and I'm giving you the truth and you can take it or leave it, but that's my truth. And when we're working in these more kind of integrated environments, either because it's a tight fandom for an indie game or it's a IP that people really love, and obviously you've dealt with all of these, how much can we challenge the player? How much can we give them our authorial intent? How much do we just have to be serving them the dish that they're expecting to eat? Like, how much wiggle room can we find? Like,
I think being in conversation and collaboration with the player, if anything, challenges us to be more challenging. Oh, I hated how that sentence came out, but you see what I mean. Which is,
I think you're right, actually, but carry on.
Yeah, I think of it like having a scene partner in theater. So just a very quick lore drop from my, I did theater all growing up and was going to major in musical theater in college. And okay. Yeah, musical theater and opera. And
I did musicals all through school years as well, actually.
Yeah.
There's a huge number of writers in the Kaleidoscope who have opera training. Really? It's really surprising.
So many. Emma Kidwell and I have talked about it. So many of us. Well, and for me, I was like, well, I'll do something more practical, like video game writing. So here we are. But for me, it is a lot like having a scene partner where there has to be this level of trust and this idea that we both know what we're doing and we know what we're looking for. And because of that, we can push and pull on each other. You expect me to come in this scene, let's say, you know, being sweet and loving, and all of a sudden I flip it, like in a way that makes sense, but now I'm aggressive. How are you going to respond to that? If you can do that in a scene with somebody you trust, you can absolutely do it in a video game if you are trusting your player and if you are trusting your player to really engage with it. I think what we see in video game audiences, there is so much creativity. There are a lot of theater kids too who play video games. I have noticed over the years. But I think a lot of players really do like to be challenged. I think that one of your tools as a writer there is, you know, coming in with authorial intent is to set up these tropes and these lofty ideas and then not to subvert them just for the, you know, for the gotcha, but to subvert them for the, this is what you expect and this is how you plan to engage, but there's something deeper here. There is something, there is a twist, there is a hook, there is a knife. And how are you going to respond to that? Are you going to barrel through it and go with your first, you know, the first idea you had about these characters and these storylines? Or are you going to pivot? Are you going to reflect? Are you going to change how you are engaging with the game? And I think those kind of sticky questions, there's no wrong answers. And that's what makes the medium so exciting.
Especially, I suppose, if you're doing branching, right? Where you can maybe offer flavors of all of those options. Like, yeah, stick with your vision of who this well-known character might be, or a character you've come to know very well, or go with the subversion, go with the twist and see like, oh, is this another angle of this character, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, you might not get that in any other medium.
Exactly. And I think that comic books are so good at doing that too, because so many of these characters are so long running. You know, these characters, some of them have existed for 40 years. So there have been, there's been every take on Spider-Man. There's been every take on Batman.
They expect a variation.
They're expecting a pivot. And if you are pivoting and subverting in ways that honor the character, that add a dimension rather than just trying to be like, oh, your favorite character sucks, actually. No, like, don't do that. But, you know, it's your character rules and is deeply human and flawed, and here's how that manifests. I think most of the time players respond really well to it. They're excited by that. They see something of themselves in those characters, and that's, you know, that's good storytelling. So
it seems like, I love that. It's kind of taking the example of comic book characters and sort of taking them into different contexts and seeing how they do in their different contexts, because pretty much every variation of like the Marvel superhero sets has been tried, and then they still find, oh, let's do all of these three guys, but now they're on the moon or whatever. And like,
they've been really vampires, werewolves. they've done all of
exactly.
it. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. But I guess, like, this is all circling around that issue. The core issue is trust, isn't it? It's like your example of a scene partner. You've got to have that trust. So I guess one way of looking at Gamergate, well, it's not good enough because the trauma is a very real thing, but that kind of breach of trust, like how do we get past a breach of trust between writer and audience? Like, because my feeling when I see that in audiences is like, right, I'm going to do everything I was doing that annoyed you three times as much because I'm right and you're wrong. But that doesn't fix trust. And I don't know what does, really.
I think a lot of people respond that way. And I mentioned this briefly in my essay. I honestly admire it in some ways because I am not a person who is driven by like, I'll show you. It's just not, it's not really my DNA. I wish it was in some days, but... So I think all of us as creatives, you come to expect criticism, right? So it's not a matter, I think that Gamergate can be equated with fair criticism, and I don't think that's accurate at all. Some people are not going to like your stories or your characters or your writing style, and that's fine. I think we've all accepted that. We've learned to live with it because that's what you do if you are a creative engaging with an audience.
And that's been true the whole time. Like nothing's changed about that. Whereas Gamergate was a thing, definitely a different thing that happened. Yeah,
100%. Yeah. So that is normal. We all expect that. You know, I have read reviews of my book, and some of them I'm like, man, that's pretty fair. Honestly, even when they were critical, I get it. Gamergate is different because it isn't engaging with the material. It's often not. Even, I mean, they haven't even played the games they're talking about. Then they admit that sometimes. It's no longer about the material. It's about the person. And it is people coming after you for who you are as a person and what you believe as a person, whether or not it ended up in your work. Of course, we put ourselves in our work. And that is why it's a breach of trust. It's not criticism of your work. It is criticism of you existing. So how do you get past that breach of trust? I wish I had perfect answers. I was searching for perfect answers while writing this essay. But what I can say is there are some facts that will help you. The fact that it is a very small portion of the audience is helpful to know. It's not perfect, but it is helpful. But I think a lot of the work has to be done internally. It has to be because if you're waiting for an apology from the people who harassed you, it's probably not coming. Even if they did go through a character arc off screen and have realized they were wrong, you're probably never getting that apology. I certainly haven't in my, you know, decade plus of working publicly. So the work is internal. The work is, how do I remind myself that the majority of the players that I came here to work with, to be my scene partner, who I love, who I want to work with, who I'm excited to create with, they are still there. They didn't go away because they were drowned out by somebody who doesn't care or cares in a very negative way. Those people did not go away. Those people still exist. And it's just finding them again, remembering that you care about them, and giving yourself the space and time to heal from that break of trust. You know, for me, and I know for some others, staying off certain websites was very helpful for a while, or leaving them entirely. Just knowing when you're in a good place to engage and when you need a break, and when it is pivoting from talking about your work and the worlds that you're creating, and it's pivoting to talking about you as a person, saying it's okay. It's okay to back up. I can give a lot of myself as a creative to the audience, but that doesn't have to be my whole self. It doesn't have to be everything about me, and creating those really healthy boundaries as well. So I guess to sum up those ideas, setting healthy boundaries and sticking to them, taking frequent breaks, and really, when you're ready, really trying to remember the rest of the audience that is there, the overwhelming majority of the audience that loves video games and comic books and books and movies. Yeah. They didn't go anywhere. They're just being drowned out right now. And it's not an easy thing to remember, but it is crucial, I think, to loving your work again.
You know, actually, a fair bit of your article is devoted to the sort of technique you could use to get around or to heal from this. And I actually think that there's something quite universal about what you've suggested, which is more than even just setting the boundary, consider the different things that you might use to heal, whatever that is. And actually that could be used for all sorts of things, right? Whether you've gone through harassment as difficult as this, but people could use those techniques for other reasons. Maybe they've been burnt out or something else has happened to them personally, right? And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about what's worked for you. What are these brain sparkers that have made a difference for you? And what do you use these days?
Sure. Yeah. So harassment has a lot of the same symptoms as any kind of trauma, like you said, right? So it results in this burnout, I think that can manifest in different ways as exhaustion, as depression, as bitterness, as kind of a little bit of hatred. And there are so many ways to heal from it. But again, I don't want to say that it's easy. For me, a lot of nature time, a lot of taking away from screens, movies that I love, it reignite that spark, music that I love that reignites that spark. Getting to create something that isn't going out to the world is also very critical to me. I think like most creative people. So, taking a pottery class and making the lumpiest, most horrific vase you've ever seen and knowing nobody's going to yell at me about it. It's just a lumpy vase that gets to live in my house.
What I like about that is it's not just purely about the healing, right? You call them brain sparkers because it's about rediscovering what got you into creative work in the first place in some ways, right? So that act of creation in other ways is a really clever solution.
Yeah, I think, so I have a best friend and we write each other short stories that we pass back and forth. We've done this since grad school and we do this even in the depth of my burnout. We've never really stopped doing that. And that's really critical too. It's an audience of one. I know she's going to love it because she loves me, whether it's good or not. And that's a brain sparker too. It's just getting to talk to, you know, for some people, it's a writing club or group or your friends or an editor that you really trust, that people who are also going to give you the feedback on, hello, as a fan of your work, this is what I really liked about it. And I think that can get you excited too, to come back and to try again.
So I was thinking, I think a lot of us writers are struggling at the moment with that question of, you know, how do we write in the difficult times in which we find ourselves? And everybody feels that they've lived in the worst time in history. If you talk to my parents living in the 80s, they were all worried about the bomb, and the bomb never dropped, but they were worried about it every night.
Sure.
But at the same time, within the course of my own lifetime anyway, this feels like as tense a brink as we've been on for quite a long time. And I think a lot of writers I see feeling a very similar feeling, and that sense of, you know, how do we write in difficult times? How do we concentrate when there is this constant alarm bell going off in the back of one's head? How do we what even is, you know, that terrible question of what is the point of writing our silly little stories when the world is on fire, which is, you know, dramatically phrased, but difficult. And I think one thing that I'm actually really appreciating hearing from you as someone who has been through a little bit of this kind of process of kind of trying to write while there is something on fire in the corner of one's mind, it's lovely to hear how holistic your kind of approach to it is. It's not just sort of, well, you have to write it this way or write for this audience or make this, you know, it's not that kind of very logical thinking, but much more, what I'm getting from it is this sense that we may be writers, but before we're writers, we're human beings, and we have to be human beings first, and then maybe we can write or something like that.
Absolutely. I think I kind of have a two-pronged approach that comes from this and also living through, you know, the world being on fire as well. The first is that I go into in the essay is taking breaks, is, I think, pushing yourself through the days where all you want to do is weep, is lay down and weep. Sometimes you just need that day. Just take that day, cry it out, come back tomorrow, rather than trying to push through and doing long-term lasting damage to yourself. I think it is critical to take those breaks. The other prong, though, is I know this can feel like cold comfort when we're going through really difficult times and things like this. However, stories do have so much power. Our silly little stories have so much power. If you think about where we are in the world right now, so much of what is going on is based on misinformation. That's a story. It's a bad story. So what counteracts it? A story that is true, even if it's fiction. There are stories that are true and are fiction that can counteract those things, that can tell the truth, that can remind everybody that we're human. And I know for me, at least, a lot of my kind of early learnings when I was emerging from a small town in the Midwest then into the world as an adult, it was reading books, it was reading articles, it was playing video games and seeing nuanced, not, you know, imperfect, but nuanced explorations of race and gender and class and struggle. And all of these things made me rely on something other than my own experience as a source of truth. And that's what we can do as storytellers too. And it's critical right now. It's so critical to see one another as people with experiences that are worth listening to, rather than barreling through reality insisting we're right. And writers have a unique ability to see these many different sides and angles, to not condemn any person or group as this is just flat out evil. No, it must be more than this. Why is this happening? Why are people acting this way and engaging this way? And, you know, really looking for this shared humanity that I think is the cure to what we're all going through. It's the only cure to what we're all going through. And it's harder to find than I think we would all like, but our work is crucial. I mean, when you look at other really dark periods of history, for me, one of the things that's been really important right now is looking at the art that came out of it. What did people create when they were suffering? What did people create when they felt powerless? And it's always very powerful.
I love that. So just to sort of summarize that idea, it's almost, it would be fair to say what you're saying is that stories are more important now in times of crisis than they ever were. When the world was safe and we were all comfortable, though that's never actually been true, then our stories were silly and they were fun. But right now our stories are actually life and death and critical. So that's the answer to why we have to be doing it. I love that, and I would vote for you. Saga, I think you have a question.
Vote for me for person on the internet.
But whatever the heck it is you want.
It did occur to me, one interesting thing about writing in our medium specifically, that might be less true when you're doing a comic, let's say, is that it's quite common to be part of some sort of creative team. We typically make games in groups, right? Not with one sole authorial voice. Or two. I suppose, John, you might be an exception as you've had a long career.
Yeah, I'm just going to sit back for the moment, but carry
on. Not me. I'm great. I'm Tolkien. Right?
You might not always have a writing team, but you'll usually have someone you're sort of submitting something to. So, it's funny because you don't. There might be times where you. It is difficult to exercise the sort of thoughts in your head or the challenges that you've come across when you just get a red line document back and you can't even put any of those things in, right? Or like you need some enemies to just be like straight up bad for this particular game that you're working on and you can't have.
Oh, I've gotten that note before. Yeah. Stop making them nuanced. I just want to stab them. I'm like, fine. Okay.
Yeah, how do you manage that? Like, how do you sort of work? Maybe there's actually an advantage in working with a fellow cohort of creatives, I suppose.
Yeah, I'll start with some of the light downsides so that I can end on the positive note. I think everybody who's worked on a large team knows you're not going to win every fight, right? And even calling it a fight is not totally accurate. It's a difference in perspective a lot of the time, right? To take that example, I want this faction to be really nuanced and deep. And, oh, isn't it so sad they're in these circumstances? And you know, the game director are going, no, we don't have the runway for it. It's a shooter, man. You just gotta let me shoot these people. Are either of us wrong or right there? I don't know, but the call has to be made at some point. I think where a lot of on big projects, especially where a lot of these projects suffer, is the inability to make a decision. So somebody making a decision, even if it's not the one you want, is good, right? Most of the time. I'm not saying I agree with every decision on every game I've ever been on, of course. And it becomes a practice in many times over a long span of years, you know, deciding what really, really matters to you as a creative and what you can kind of let go of and live with, right? And that is its own form of self-care. So that's some of the downsides. Sure, you're not going to win. You don't have complete control over everything. Some of the upsides, though, you know, you said you working with a bunch of people who have different perspectives and backstories. Thank God. You know, like if when I'm writing by myself, I like writing by myself. I like writing books and comic books, although comics are also very, very collaborative. But when I'm on a team of writers, getting to hear all these different perspectives, getting to hash it out in a writer's room is so exciting. I'm learning so much from people who have different experiences than I do. That's deepening the worlds, the stories, adding nuanced takes. It to me, it's just, it's a creative sparker again. I I love to just ping one of my fellow writers or five of them and be like, hey, I'm working on this, this plot beat, and this is what I think it's saying. What do you guys think it's saying? And get seven different opinions. And I'm like, okay, I need to clear this up. But also just getting to paint it back and forth, I think it's one of the best parts of the job. It's why I like working on big projects, is getting to work with other people. I love working on smaller projects for like just being able to kind of own the vision. But there's a real advantage too in not owning the vision and getting to share it with others.
Yeah, I'm just processing. I really like that.
Yeah, I don't have any experience of writers' rooms at all, but And part of me, it's really interesting to me, just because that balance of are you supercharging your writing? Are you kind of trading it up and trading it up the whole time from all these contributions? Or are you averaging it across a group of people?
Sure.
And I wonder, do both things happen in writers' rooms?
Is it
absolutely. I think one of the real fears of writers who spend most of their time in writers' rooms is losing sense of your own voice, right? If you're constantly asking, what do you want from this project, and delivering that, the term I hear a lot is like, well, you're a workhorse. Like, you're very good at delivering what people are asking for. But you can lose your own voice after a while. It's why most of the people I know who work on big projects, myself included, are always working on their side novel, right? Whether or not it ever comes out,
always.
It's about continuing to defend and understand your own ideas about storytelling and your own voice and your own perspective as a person. It's why I do so many side projects too, specifically that are not other video games with big teams. It's side projects that are, I get a lot more say over what the story is, just to remind myself what is coming from me and what is coming from other people on my team.
Mm. I love that, right? Because it's the sense of creative power or you just sort of hanker after, like, can I just have some control over a world or a story? And like, maybe you want to have something that's a bit more inter-genre, and that just doesn't fly for a project that needs to sell a certain number of copies or something. And you're like, well, how do I possibly go after that? Right. Like, I got into games like relatively late in my career. And I remember working with, there were like two full-time writers, in a room with the creative director. And I was often there as well. And I remember being so surprised, thinking that for games, like, what people would want to do would be to sort of be the singular voice. And our lead writer at the time was like, no, I'm in this medium so I can bounce off of other people. Like, I much more enjoy writing in that context, he told me. And I that's never quite left my mind, actually. I'm like, this is not exclusively a weakness, right? It gives you something too.
It really does. It really pushes you, it challenges you, right? I kind of know what I tend to choose if I'm making choices about how to tell a story. I reliably know what I'm going to choose, what the characters are going to be like, how things are going to resolve. And then you just add a second person, even, who's like, no, I am more of a pessimist than you, or whatever. Now it's challenging me to go, are they right? Is this a different angle on it that's interesting? Or should I fight for what I want here? Do I really, am I sure that I'm right in this instance? So I think it adds a lot. I also do think and know and have been through, after a few weeks of intense horse trading on AAA, just being like, I just want to decide that the curtains are blue. I'm just going to write them as blue. I don't want to have 18 meetings about it. I'm just going to make a choice here. So I think both are totally valid.
Yeah, I love the description of a workhorse, because you're right. As soon as you say it, you think, oh, that's a bad thing to be. But like, a workhorse is a horse that does loads of work, right? That's a good thing.
Sure. Like, it's necessary.
They need workhorses. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I don't think it's a bad thing. Yeah, it's just, but is it the only thing you want to be in your career?
Yes.
Probably not. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe workhorses also go home and do some jumping just to keep themselves firm.
Maybe they make crappy pottery. Maybe we all know.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I don't think horses make good pottery.
Yes, that's right. They make something, It's funny that, go ahead, John.
Oh, well, I was going to ask about something sort of related to it. I was thinking about, again, about combative audiences, though actually I think some of what you said was that almost the audience that's combative isn't actually the audience at all. They're this other group of people who are kind of glued on the side of the real audience, who are actually more interesting and collaborative, so that's kind of interesting. But when you're writing games that have these large audiences, I was thinking about Miles Morales in particular. Like, how important is authenticity to you and accuracy, especially when you know that the audience is going to be up in your face about everything? And when you're writing something that's super grounded in a real place in a real time, so less in an IP, but more in the real world, how do you go about achieving that authenticity? How do you know when you've done enough? Like, how do you find that voice? Because that seems to me like the one thing as a writer myself, I mostly write about British people because that's what I know. And I wrote this one game about Scotland and it was terrifying because I don't know enough about Scotland. And at the end of the project, I still don't know enough about Scotland. And I'm very conscious of that. So how do you deal with that?
Yeah, it is absolutely critical to me. Authenticity is so, so critical to me. I was keenly aware when working on Miles Morales that I am a white woman from the Midwest. Like, that is, you know, I am not from Harlem or Brooklyn, or which is where, you know, our characters are from in Miles. So it was so critical, and a lot of work went into it. As I'm sure with you writing about Scotland, both reading a lot of people with the lived experience, watching documentaries, traveling to New York. I'd actually lived in Harlem for a while right out of college, and kind of looking at my old pictures and things I would see every morning. We empowered the actors quite a bit, which was important in that process to give us feedback. Is this how you think your character would say? You understand your character. You understand where they're coming from. Do you think this is how you would say it? And sometimes they said no, like not really. especially when writing the character Haley in Miles Morales, who she uses ASL. And she gave a ton of feedback on those lines of, this is not how a person would say this in ASL. Do you mind if I tweak it a little bit? And the answer, yes, of course, please. Like, make it more authentic. Make it something that if you were an audience member playing this, you would be excited to see this on screen because it feels real. So I think, again, it's this open collaboration of trusting the other creatives you're working with. We also did focus groups. We did testing. You know, we pulled in people like, hello, you are a group of people from Brooklyn. Does this feel real to you? Or are they saying this in a silly way? We had people who speak Puerto Rican Spanish in to kind of review some of the scenes with Rio and be like, is this how she would say this? And often the answer was yes. And sometimes the answer was, oh, absolutely not. You know, one of my favorite pieces of feedback we got was like, Rio is being way too nice to her son. Like, specifically, she sounds like a Midwestern mom. And I was like, got me. That is exactly what I am. And, you know, that feedback changed the scene and for the better. People loved it in the final release. So all that is to say, it's doing your research is so important to me as a writer. And I think also having that research to back you up in a game like Miles Morales, where you do have a large audience, many of them will come in with lived experience you don't have, but your characters do. So they'll be looking at it through that lens. But having that research to back you up when someone above you or even at your level is trying to make a decision that is inaccurate is critical. So someone's saying, no, Rio needs to be sweetness and light in this scene. And I'm like, well, I talked to the focus group and they said, she sounds like a Midwestern mom. So I think we should rewrite it. You know, just having all those points in your favor when on a creative team is really important. And I just think we talked earlier about setting up tropes only to subvert them in interesting ways, challenge them, push them, find new dimensions of humanity and how humans are. Research can do that. Research, you know, if I am familiar with a trope because I read a lot of books and then I talk to people and say, this is what the trope always gets wrong, there you go. I have a new angle to pursue. Whether I take it one for one or I, you know, try to weave it in a new and exciting way, either will work, but it really challenges you to think differently than all of what is happening in media and only pulling from what is happening in media.
It's so funny. It's like there's a slight arbitrariness to how some of these characters happen to have been set in at least named real world places, even if the way that character over the decades has developed, you know, maybe it doesn't really bear much relation to what the New York of today looks like or whatever, right? Like,
sure.
I'm writing a DLC for a game that's set in Seattle, And it's like in actual Seattle, right? So there's so much you can do with a real grounded setting. But you know, if I were writing something set in Gotham, the trade-off is I don't have real grounded people I can go speak to who live in Gotham, but I have a lot of freedom, right? Like I can make up a zone, a district, an entire like fashion style, like all of these different things that you can do. So it's funny actually. You can kind of, there are real trade-offs to that type of choice, right?
Yeah, I've absolutely also worked in cities that did not exist, worlds that did not exist. But then I think, especially when you're on a big team, having references is so important because otherwise we're going to be writing, you know, 17 different versions of Gotham, right? It's like somebody is writing Gotham from the Nolan movies, somebody's writing Gotham from Frank Miller, someone else is writing like a Game of Thrones Gotham. What the hell are you doing? You know, it can get kind of crazy. So. Again, that research just becomes so important because you need a common reference point early on, even if it's just you writing up, you know, spec scripts, that will help, right?
I love this model of the writer as almost like a researcher collecting in all of this information and processing and synthesizing it, only instead of synthesizing it into an essay or an ethnography or something really formal like that, we're synthesizing it into a story about a dude with superpowers who punches people. I just think that's so good.
I think it... in so many ways is more welcoming than like sitting down and saying, read Encyclopedia Britannica. This is how you are going to learn about the world. Yes. Versus like play a video game and learn about people who are different from you, who exist in the real world. And because we have put it through the narrative lens, are exciting, are doing exciting things, are going through character arts. It's not just we pointed a camera at a street and, you know, watch it for 2 hours and see if anything interesting happens. So it's just a more accessible way to learn, I think.
I feel like it's often that way, right? Like you have little bits of the world that you would love to expose, but that are not maybe absolutely essential. And when it makes sense for a character who has to have a reason to be there anyway, to be able to evoke one of those things, fabulous, right? Like, it's funny. It actually brings me back to your article a little bit because you talked about the film that I have seen more than any other over these last 12 months, which is Kiki's Delivery Service. There is no movie I've been watching more because it is like the one film that I've had my daughter start to watch. She doesn't really, you know, she's like 3, right? She doesn't really watch many movies. And this Ursula character is so great, right? But like, it's so clearly, Ursula was so clearly a voice of someone in Ghibli, you know, that was like, I need someone to sort of show Kiki that things could get better. And it really felt like one of these moments where it both expanded the world, but also gave, it was sort of a perspective that they wanted to show their protagonist that felt so real, right? So real to even the very topic you were writing about.
Totally. I think that when we talk about authenticity, in some ways you can go a little bit too far in that it's just like everybody just exists as people and they don't have any narrative utility anymore. And you're like, why am I playing this? Like, why am I talking to these people? Yeah. So you still have to put it through the lens of, I'm doing all this research. I have all this information on how the world works and how people are and what their experiences are, but also what is this adding in the story? You have to do both, right? And so that's a great example. Ursula is grounded in the world. We know why she is here. We know how she got here. She tells you, but her narrative utility is without her, Kiki's arc does not happen. Kiki does not learn how to heal, right? I think video games, especially large video games, this is incredibly challenging because, you know, on some of the bigger video games, you're creating hundreds of NPCs. Do they all have that much narrative utility? Probably not, but they should have some. You know, one of the things I wrote in Miles Morales was the Harlem quest line. And the Harlem quest line is about, it's optional, it's open world. It is about Miles falling in love with Harlem, where he has just moved. So that was the stated goal. He is falling in love with his new neighborhood. But I created all the NPCs he meets along the way. And so each one of them had to show him a different dimension of this neighborhood and one that he could fall in love with and one that could welcome him. So when I was writing all of these NPCs, it was about what is their place? How are they grounded in the neighborhood? So we have people who volunteer, we have people who create street art, we have people, you know, all of these people who are really like baked into the neighborhood. We have somebody who owns a restaurant, all these things. And it then became about like, what does Miles see in them? Basically, he sees courage, he sees compassion, he sees people who are fighting back against, you know, people trying to shove into their neighborhood and take things from them. He sees this kind of bite that I think is critical to people who are from Harlem. And he loves that. He's a superhero. He punches for a living. So he's really into that dynamic. And these people, as you complete the quest, you know, they start calling out to him. They know him. They recognize him. That's our guy. And that is the experience of falling in love with a place that you have just moved. So that was really critical to me. It was not just about creating NPCs who are interesting or are real. It was are real and are drawing Miles into this neighborhood that he is going to become representative of.
I love that. In fact, he's recreating the community that he maybe didn't have when he started, which brings us back full circle to the sort of topic that we sort of began with.
Expertly done, yeah.
Expertly done, by Mary
Kay. I love it. So rich and so human. And there are a couple of things in your article in the conversation that I really like. I love the distinction between inspiration and a brain sparker. Like this idea that inspiration is something you have to use because you've got to be on the hustle. And if you're not taking it in and putting it out there, then you're not doing it right. And I love that idea that we should give ourselves the space to go into the world and just become richer as creatures, as people. Mm. And if that feeds into the work eventually, maybe it'll just be because we get to do it, not because that individual thing is useful. I thought that was just a superb distinction to draw. And I love this idea that you say in your article, but you've made it very, very clear throughout this conversation that you write from a place of love. I think that's wonderful. I write from a place of spite. I always have done. Like most of my writing is because I play something or I read something where I think that's really popular and I don't like it. It ought to be like this. Like that's my primary motivation is to fix things, and it always has been.
One of my favorite co-writers I've ever had was the same way though, and we bounce so well off each other because he is a very spite-driven writer, and I am such a love-driven writer. And because of that, we could bounce off each other. We could challenge each other. I could be like, "Man, we got to be a little nicer in this scene," and he could be like, "This scene's more bite. This scene's too challenged. This needs to push." And it was a really great experience. So,
I love this. Maybe through the process of this podcast, I'll meet enough writers that I can produce a full taxonomy of them. Because right now, is it just a binary? Is it a yin yang of love and spite that's being the primary motivator? Or is there a mysterious third motivator? Who knows? Maybe we'll find out. But thank you. I got a huge amount from this conversation. I hope our listeners have as well. I'm going to wrap it up there. So I just want to say thank you again, Mary, for joining us and for writing for the book.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it. And I was so excited to be alongside so many wonderful people in the book, many of them friends. It's a fantastic work. So thank you so much.
Thank you. And please join us again next week when we will open another article from the book and see who we get. So thank you again for listening.
Thank you very much, everyone. See you next time.